Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, how China's use of Cold War-style spycraft almost destroyed a Massachusetts company.
A private company can't compete against the resources of the second largest economy in the world.
Also today, virtual reality comes to the ICA.
It leaves a physical sensation that your whole body experiences it, as opposed to just a cerebral or visual experience, the way that we might think about a painting or a sculpture.
And what school could be? Former venture capitalist Ted Dintersmith visited 200 schools across the country to see what's working, what's broken, and how American education needs to transform for the 21st century.
It is not the teacher's fault. The teachers are the heroes of this. It's education is that one area of life in our country where non-experts tell the experts what to do.
That's all next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. President Donald Trump fired off a bunch of tweets in the past 24 hours, and in the barrage, there was this one. Quote, President Xi and I will always be friends, no matter what happens with our dispute on trade. China will take down its trade barriers because it is the right thing to do. Taxes will become reciprocal, and a deal will be made on intellectual property. Great future for both countries! Exclamation point, end quote. Now, you'll recall that in the escalating tit-for-tat trade tensions between China and the U.S., late last month, the Trump administration ordered a 25% tariff on some $50 billion worth of Chinese tech products for what the U.S. calls China's harmful acts, policies, and practices when it comes to American intellectual property. In fact, the U.S. Trade Representative recently concluded that Chinese theft of American IP currently costs between $225 billion and $600 billion annually. Well, if you think all of that is just bluster, consider this.
This is a serious threat to our national security. I mean, our economy depends on the ability to innovate. And if there's a dedicated nation state who's using its intelligence apparatus to steal day in and day out what we're trying to develop, that poses a serious threat to our country.
And that comes not from a member of the Trump administration, but a man named John Carlin, Assistant Attorney General for National Security in the Justice Department in the Obama administration. He spoke to CBS's 60 Minutes back in 2016. So, in fact, there is bipartisan agreement that Chinese practices around IP are problematic, to say the least. And the issue is vitally important to Massachusetts tech sector. So we're going to look at two things today. First, a Massachusetts company that had its IP stolen by a Chinese firm. And second, we'll talk about the ample disagreement on whether tariffs are the best way to deal with the China challenge. So joining me first is Daniel McGann. He's CEO of American Superconductor. They're based in Ayr, and they make control systems for wind turbines. Daniel McGann, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
Okay, so you are the company that had your IP stolen by China.
We are that company, yeah.
And it started back in what, 2005, 2006?
So the relationship goes back about that far. The theft actually occurs in the late days of 2010 into 2011.
Okay. But I kind of started back in 2005, 2006 because that's when American Superconductor wanted to enter the Chinese wind turbine market.
Right. So our model is very similar. If you know the Russian nested doll series of different layers, we would work with the local partner on the outer layers, which are making a wind turbine. So mm-hmm. trying to do that analogy through the tech transfer. We do that legally. But then we would reserve 5 to 10% of the content, really the software, the operating system, and the hardware controllers that make the wind turbine perform well. That content comes from us. So the inner layers of that nested wooden doll, if you're using that as an analogy.
Got it. Now, but when you decided to try and enter the Chinese market, you were already concerned about the the vulnerability of having your IP stolen.
Well, you hear the stories and you know, when we went over, I actually interviewed people that wanted to be the general manager of our Chinese operation that basically went through the process on how they stole IP from other Western companies. So you kind of learn as you go and you go in eyes wide open and try to protect yourself. So we segregated IP for what was in China, what was in Europe, what was in Massachusetts, what was in Wisconsin. And we made sure there wasn't an easy way that those parts could come together until an actual crime was committed.
Right. I want to get to that in a second. But so you segregated the IP. You even took it off the internet, right?
Right,
so they shouldn't have been able to get to it, you know, directly just by a hack.
Correct.
Okay.
And the way the wind turbine works, so your listeners understand, all the controls talk to each other and they all identify that they come from the same source, American Superconductor. And they do that. All that communication happened under an encrypted protocol, which the Chinese were unable to turn off. They had 800 R&D engineers trying to reverse engineer everything we could do. They were unsuccessful in doing that, and they had to resort to outright theft to get what they wanted.
Okay. And this is where it becomes very cloak and dagger, actually. I mean, it's almost unbelievable, but it happened. So you partnered with this company, Sinovel, this Chinese company, and they somehow turned, I guess there's no other way to put it, right?
Yeah.
Turned one of your European contractors?
Yeah. So think about how big this got. So they went and they became number one in China by 2008 and number two in the world. They were bigger than General Electric by 2009. They liked the technology so much that they wanted it all. So they coerced. They used, spycraft era type, it's like a Tom Clancy novel, or any kind of spy versus spy type arrangement where they offered them money, they offered them women, they offered them a different life.
This is a contractor in Austria.
This is
Austria.
A direct employee.
Wasn't direct
a
employee,
right,
that's
right, right. So he's a Serbian national working in Austria. He's already been tried, convicted. He confessed to the crime.
Yeah.
They basically had set up a whole new life for him in Beijing that he was unable to get to because we were able to work with Austrian authorities to catch him.
I mean, they said there's text messages that have been shown that he said he wanted women and money and they were ready to give him $1.7 million and they were really buttering him up and so what did he end up giving them?
What he did, and he was kind of smart about it, which helps us, he was able to transfer some of the outer source code at the turbine level. But at our hardware controller, what he did is he recompiled new versions. So if we do this by analogy, like Windows, there used to be Windows 3.1. So imagine like Windows 3.4 shows up. There was never Windows 3.4. So you see this new version that he turned off this encryption. He added some features that were being tested and tried out in China at the time. And that's how we knew. There was a wind farm that was operating. The turbines were still spinning. We had put in code to turn it off by a certain time. They continued to operate beyond that time window. And we knew there was an issue at that point.
That's just amazing. It's amazing, right?
We tried to put in every piece of protection we could think of. And I think, the fact that they actually had to resort to spycraft and theft to get what they wanted proves that the level of protection was probably more sophisticated than most industrial products that go into China.
So when those turbines in that one test facility were still spinning, even though they were supposed to be off, what was your first reaction?
We knew we had a problem. The question is, what was the problem?
Yeah.
And we did some analysis looking at our own people who had access, who had motive, who had the ability to be able to be in China and deliver this technology to them. And it really came down to one person very quickly. Mm. We work with authorities in Austria because that's where he was at the time, and we're able to catch him.
Right. So he admits the crime. He does a year in jail.
He confessed. Right. Okay. He got sentenced 3. I think he had a year plus time served.
Okay. But then we have Sinovel, right?
It would be 10 years if it was in the U.S., just to give you.
Okay. Yeah. But, I mean, we still have Sinovel, this massive company.
And we still have about 20% of the fleet of all the wind turbines in China that are owned by the Chinese government still operating under stolen code.
To this day?
To this day.
Your stolen code?
Yes.
What has this cost your company?
Well, it cost shareholders in about a day almost $1 billion. The damages we're seeking in China are to the tune of $1.2 billion. The damages that the U.S. Department of Justice have ascribed to this, so they related this to akin to attempted corporate homicide. The Wall Street Journal reported damages of $4.8 billion. So it's a big number regardless of what you look at. And if they can do this for wind turbines are one of the most benign products on the planet, right? To want to go and steal that technology, you can only imagine if you're an industrial company doing something less benign. That the Chinese may want that too.
There's one more layer of the mind-boggling nature of the lengths that China went to get your technology. Because do I remember the chronology right? Even after that former employee had admitted to his crimes, that a branch of the Chinese military performed a successful spear phishing attack on your company to get even more IP or?
Yeah, there was. So we have other businesses and we can talk about how the business is doing today, maybe. But there was other technology around wind that they didn't get. We knew that they didn't get. They knew they didn't get. And they were trying to find, you know, a way to get additional technology through means through the PLA.
Okay. The Chinese military.
Charming, yeah.
All right. So in 2016, you talked to 60 Minutes and there's a scene where you're walking through your manufacturing facility, and it's empty. And at that point in time, you had said that you had to lay off some 300 people.
It was almost 700.
Almost 700 people.
Yeah.
Okay. Oh, I got the numbers backward. Right. Almost 700 out of roughly 900 you had employed at that time. That was 2016. Give me some good news.
Is things going
better now?
We took what we learned in China. What we were selling was basically the operating system, the software, and a pallet of parts, and then allow them to make their end control system on their own. We don't allow customers to do that anymore. We do it all ourselves. We do end-to-end. So we've helped to create one of the largest wind turbine companies in India and one of the largest wind turbine companies in South Korea. But that's only a piece of our business. We made a strategic decision to diversify into making the grid more resilient, allowing it to work with more resiliency, and making the U.S. Navy more resilient, surface ships from mines and mine fields.
Good.
So we've taken other technology and found ways to deploy it in other markets and then rebuild this company.
Great. It's good to hear, because there's one more part of the story of what happened to American Superconductor that I just have to touch on, because it's so – I mean, it's like it's where the rub is, right? That you had your Massachusetts company. You have your technology stolen by China, and yet there is a wind turbine in the state of Massachusetts running that stolen technology?
Right. So there are a few of them, and that's the evidence that went into the U.S. Department of Justice case against the Chinese, which we got a criminal conviction
in January.
Just in January, and sentencing is scheduled to occur in June.
But taxpayer dollars were used to buy one of those.
Taxpayer dollars. So if you go back to the beginning of Obama and TARP and stimulus money was used for federal taxpayers to the Commonwealth of Massachusetts to purchase wind turbines that had stolen software from a Massachusetts company.
That is head smacking, I have to say. A couple more quick questions for you, Dan. You've been so generous in sharing your story here. So you mentioned that, yes, in January there was a decision by a federal jury in this DOJ case against Sinovel, the company that you had partnered with in China, and they found that, yes, Sinovel did steal your trade secrets. And U.S. Attorney Scott Blader says of that January conviction, again, of this year, that it sends a strong and clear message to that the theft of ideas and ingenuity is not a business dispute. It's a crime and will be prosecuted as such. How important do you think that verdict is?
We think it's critical, because what it does is it puts this administration on the hook, and you can see it in the daily events today. We're talking about trade issues with China. Front and center is our issue with its intellectual property, and ultimately what they're after is, we've tried and convict you in our courts. We want the Chinese system to work. If you're a member of WTO, you need to have your laws work and these mechanisms to be able to protect IP. Xi Jinping himself has come out very strongly saying we need to punish the wrongdoers that steal intellectual property. And our case is kind of the poster child for really testing, does the Chinese system allow for protection of these intellectual property rights from Western companies? And that's why we have all these cases over in China. So if they just enforce their own laws, this should come ultimately to a positive outcome for our company.
But that's a really big if, though. So finally, let me ask you then, what do you think of the fact that it's the Trump administration that has imposed these tariffs, perhaps as a lever to do exactly what you're saying? It didn't happen under the Obama administration. Do you think these tariffs are a good step or not?
It's certainly different. So to evaluate if it's good or bad, I got to focus on the outcome and see what comes of it. I know, you know, because we were very much involved with then Secretary Kerry and then Secretary Clinton and all the Obama administration up to six cabinet level officials and the vice president. Every 6 months there is negotiated economic diplomacy between the countries. And I can say that that obviously didn't work. Scheduling these dialogues didn't allow these issues to get resolved. So maybe this unscheduled whatever this is that we're going through will help at least bring the sides to the table and realize that both sides can win on this issue.
Well, Daniel McGann is president and CEO of American Superconductor based in Ayer. Thank you so much for sharing your story.
Thank you. Appreciate the opportunity.
All right. Let's turn now to Joel Trachman. He's a professor of international law at the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy at Tufts University. Professor Trachman, welcome to you.
Thanks so much, Magna.
Let's pick up where Dan left off. I mean, with the story of what happened to American Superconductor in the background, do you think that these tariffs are a step in the right direction or not?
Well, as Dan said, we need to focus on the outcome. And a lot depends on what the Chinese reaction will be and what the United States' reaction to their reaction will be. And right now, we're kind of in a trade war, or at least in a proposed trade war. Nothing, you know, the shooting hasn't begun yet. But if these tariffs are imposed, it will hurt many producers in the United States, consumers in the United States, a lot of people in China. If the outcome instead is for China to improve its intellectual property practices, as it's agreed to do in a number of contexts, that could be a good thing.
Okay. So to me, that's one of the key questions here. I think it was what Dan was getting at is, what are the means by which the United States can encourage exactly this, the improvement in China on intellectual property practices? I was seeing that, for example, a couple of members, former members of the Obama administration, Matthew Goodman and Eli Ratner, were writing in Foreign Affairs that they think that the U.S. should lead with the positive vision, in their words, of what 21st century trade practices should look like. Right. And help set that agenda. Their argument was that things like the Trans-Pacific Partnership would have done exactly that. Your thoughts?
I don't think that the Trans-Pacific Partnership would have prevented the kinds of outcomes that Dan's company has had, that American Superconductor has had. I think that it would have improved intellectual property protection, but I think we need more. The United States has been negotiating a bilateral investment treaty with China. When the United States negotiated with China its terms of accession to the World Trade Organization, we specifically put into their agreement a commitment not to require intellectual property transfers as a condition for investment.
Right.
And there are other provisions, including provisions in the WTO Trade and Intellectual Property Rights Agreement, that say you can't discriminate, you have to enforce intellectual property rights. There's a long chapter of that on enforcement, and the United States has brought cases against China on the quality of its enforcement.
Okay, so should it be doing more of that then? It may be in concert with other allies who may have suffered the same fate with Chinese IP practices.
So I think other allies are interested. You know, the United States has brought a case at the World Trade Organization for these intellectual property practices, and a number of countries, including the European Union and Japan and Taiwan and a number of other countries, have joined. So other countries have experienced these problems, and they want to do something about it. The problem is the law is not so clear that there's an absolute right to a decision, and it may be that China finds it's more valuable to continue doing what it's doing and accept the retaliation that would occur under World Trade Organization law than to change its practices.
How likely do you think that is?
We'll have to see. So far, China has decided, as evidenced by practice, to continue to do these things despite objections. So these concerns have been on the table for at least a decade.
Yeah.
And the United States has been discussing it with China, has been trying to induce China to change, and China hasn't changed. And there's a lot of value that China receives from violating American intellectual property.
Yeah, I mean, sort of another way to put that, and this has nothing, this is a separate set of data, but I just think it's equally compelling. I'm looking here, according to the New York Times, that China's share of U.S. imports to the U.S. in computers and electronics, for example, is 46%, according to the New York Times. So you touched on this at a little earlier, Joel, but there are potential negative consequences to both of some American businesses and American consumers here.
So I think when Donald Trump came into office, he wanted to impose tariffs on China. And he was very single-minded about that. And he went to Bob Lighthizer at the United States Trade Representative and he said, give me tariffs. And in some ways, this issue of intellectual property is an excuse to impose tariffs on China to respond to concerns, which I think are erroneous, about the bilateral trade deficit with China. And we're doing that. But as you say, it's hurting the United States to do this, both as an importer, because we have complex supply chains that need components from China, and for consumers, but also as an exporter. And the farmers in the Midwest are getting killed by even the threat of these sanctions that China is proposing to put on.
Right. I mean, which is why Apple, Dell, IBM, Google, the supply chain issues, the reason why they are very unhappy about these tariffs. But let me just let me get back to one quick thing, and perhaps at the risk of asking again, because I'm seeking for answers here. Am I hearing you say that perhaps the best way to further the development of or the improvement of Chinese IP practices is, again, through the WTO or through improvements at the WTO, through changes, through bringing more cases?
So the existing law probably is not sufficient.
Is not adequate. Okay.
To solve all of these problems, partly because the remedies for sanctions are not necessarily significant enough, the remedy for violations. And so new law, new rules, and better enforcement of the existing Chinese intellectual property laws would be a solution. I think the kinds of pressure that Dan has been talking about are ways to perhaps highlight these issues, let United States companies know about these issues as they invest. One of the proposals that the Trump administration has made is to make it tougher for Chinese companies to invest in the United States. And those kinds of things will put pressure on the Chinese government. So I think this is a management issue, a negotiation issue that may take some time to work out.
Well, Joel Trachtman is a professor of international law at the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy at Tufts University. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Meghna.
And a little earlier, we heard from Daniel McGann, president and CEO of American Superconductor. Great conversation about a Massachusetts company that was fighting back against Chinese stealing of his intellectual property. We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Virtual reality isn't just for video games, film festivals, amusement parks, or the malls. It's entering art museums. As VR technology has improved and become cheaper, more artists and curators are experimenting with it as a medium for expression. WBUR's Andrea Shea visited the Institute of Contemporary Art Boston to find out more about VR's arrival.
The ICA's site-specific virtual reality piece takes you on an immersive, apocalyptic journey. You begin on the museum's fourth floor, standing in front of a long glass wall perched on the edge of Boston Harbor. But the building and landscape transform into darker versions of themselves after you slip on the Oculus Rift goggles. In the distance, a wave is moving toward you. Seagulls flee. Then a massive wall of water crests over your head. The tsunami smashes the museum to pieces and plunges you beneath the surf with artworks, shards of glass, and contorted bodies.
It almost felt like it was like out of body because you can't see your legs, you can't see your arms, you're kind of just like floating in like this digital void. And so it's like a very surreal experience.
24-year-old Stephen Griswold is wobbly after experiencing the 8-minute nightmarescape of climate change disaster.
It's kind of scary a little bit, but it's also like really cool, and it's like it is slightly unsettling. I did get a little nervous.
What I love about the piece is that you start grounded in the real and you end up in the virtual in a way that, you know, only artists can imagine.
That's Chief Curator Ava Raspini. She commissioned the virtual reality work, a first for the ICA.
It's new territory for museums. I think it's really new territory for us. Most of the visitors have never done a VR piece, period. And if they have done it, maybe it's been in the context of gaming or another kind of context that's not a museum context. So certainly our viewers are learning, as are we.
Raspini says with the VR piece, the ICA is introducing new ways of seeing and feeling art.
It leaves a physical sensation that your whole body experiences it, as opposed to just a cerebral or visual experience, the way that we might think about a painting or a sculpture. So in that sense, it really engages all senses in a way that no other work does.
Why in a museum? Why here?
Joe Thompson, director of the Massachusetts Museum of Contemporary Art, was skeptical about including VR installations at his museum in North Adams. He's long been wary of high-tech gizmos getting in between visitors and artworks. VR is discombobulating and cumbersome, he says, requiring people to suit up with goggles and gloves. But musician and multimedia artist Laurie Anderson won Thompson over with her ambitious creations that went up at Mass MoCA last year. He says the pieces are probing, thought-provoking, and break down barriers between the artist and the viewers.
There's nothing wrong with spectacle. I'm a big fan. But in an art museum, you expect your spectacle to come laden with more layers of meaning and to tell you something about the world we live in. And if it stops at gloss and glitter, it's probably in the wrong place.
Plenty of people are asking the big question, is virtual reality art?
And I don't know if it's been answered yet. I mean, I think one has to be critical of it as a medium, and I'm trying to explore how it can be, you know, elevated to that status.
That's John Raffman, the Canadian artist behind the ICA's new piece. He recalls how throughout history, new mediums like photography and film have been scorned, and operas had the power to cause riots in the streets. Raffman says art today perhaps needs to find ways to pull in and engage intimately, almost aggressively, with modern viewers.
It needs to wrestle to get your attention so much now because there's so many distractions or there's so much informational overload. And in a way, VR is like a technology that does that because it violently traps you within its world.
In this moment, Raffman feels like a VR art pioneer.
On one level, it's exciting because the art institutions are giving opportunities for artists to explore and like understand the meaning and the possibilities and how it can be used as a critical media, virtual reality. And on another level, it's great because it attracts, you know, maybe some people who wouldn't otherwise be enthusiastic museum goers.
Raffman thinks VR could be one of the most important mediums of our era. At the ICA, 17-year-old visitor Pablo Robin says it's pretty cool, but he makes his own prediction.
I think it'll, like, wear out, or, like, the gimmick won't be there anymore. Nobody's going to want to come to the Louvre just to put a mask on their head.
But Christine Klein of Jamaica Plain says VR should be part of a contemporary art museum's evolution.
Museums shouldn't be stagnant paintings. They should be forums for discussion, for thought. But this is taking it to a whole new level in a fascinating way.
Even so, adapting to technological change is challenging. Some museums are in no rush to bring in VR, not knowing if it'll be novelty or new frontier. But ICA curator Ava Raspini likens it to a mirror, reflecting society, whether we choose to look or not.
WBUR's Andrea Shea. We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. If you could change one thing to transform the American classroom, what would it be? I mean, I'm talking really transformational change here. What would that classroom look like? What would those kids be learning? How would they be learning it? And most importantly, why would they be learning it? Well, Ted Dinter-Smith has an answer. He's a former venture capitalist with a keen interest in education, and he recently went about doing his own kind of experiential learning when it comes to the future of American education. For the entire 2015-2016 school year, he traveled to each and every state, visited some 200 schools, met with everyone from students and teachers to school boards, legislators, and governors, and he compiled what he learned into the new book, What School Could Be, Insights and Inspiration from Teachers Across America. And Ted Dinter-Smith joins us today from New York. Welcome back to Radio Boston, Ted.
Great to be here.
Okay, so I am a very learn-by-example kind of person, so I would like to start off with a specific example that you bring up in the book about a classroom that, in your mind, really describes what school could be like. It's in Fort Wayne, Indiana, and it's the classroom of Jared Nipper, a kindergarten teacher. What's so special about what he's doing?
Well, Jared, you have to visualize. I meet him at a community forum, and he stands up, and he's about 6'2", 300 pounds. He looks like an offensive lineman for the Indianapolis Colts. And I thought this guy was going to just say, you know, go away. You know, I don't believe anything you're saying. And he goes into this great story about taking over a kindergarten class, his first chance to teach, and connecting these kids to challenges like designing robots and doing 3D printing. And it was just such a telling story. And I'd include at the very top of the list, he didn't know anything about those topics at the start. Took these kids out to Fort Wayne. They raised money from the community to get the equipment. And then they just learned together about it. And I tracked him during the school year. Those kids were on fire. It was just an inspiring story from an unlikely place.
Well, you say that he wanted his class to be all about making things. And because he has an interesting background too, right? Former police officer and a coach as well. And how did this all come together to make a class? I mean, kindergartners making, designing prostheses is pretty cool. But they're still kindergartners though, right?
Very. And these kids can do it. I mean, I think that's what I heard over and over again in all sorts of settings, is that if you trust the teacher, and Jared had a principal that trusted him, and you let these kids go on challenges they care about, that's when the magic happens. You know, but Jared, in his police role, had been kind of a, almost like a on-site security guy for one of the schools. And he said, oh my gosh, these kids, by the time they get to high school, kids he was coaching, they seem to have lost their curiosity and got really passionate about the idea of teaching, got his teaching credential, got a chance to teach. I stay in close contact with him. He's now principal of an elementary school. So he's really making huge strides in Fort Wayne.
Wow. Okay. So how then, keeping Jared Nipper's kindergarten classroom as our example, how then does that differ from what we would typically think is the kind of learning that goes on in American classrooms?
Well, I would contrast Jared, what he did, with what Jared was told to do by the state of Indiana. And what he said to me, half joking but quite seriously, is that when he got his marching orders, it called for having these kids do 90-minute uninterrupted blocks of reading time. And he laughed. He said to me, do the people who make these things up ever spend time with a five-year-old? My kids don't want to sit in a desk for 90 straight minutes. And so he thought carefully about what types of challenges would appeal to this particular set of kids that would get them motivated to learn to read and learn basic math skills, but in the context of something they thought was really cool. And his principal backed him up. He said, you'll have some detractors, and he did. But he kind of won everybody over. And he's one of many, but I met these teachers all over the country that had that same mindset about leading with engaging their kids and having the support and trust of people around them.
Okay. So Ted, it's really interesting because you talk about in your book how in your view, there are a lot of things holding back American education from where it needs to be for the 21st century. And we'll get into some more of those, a couple more of those things a little later in this conversation. But you also discuss that it's still, aspects of it are kind of frozen in time, that we've been doing teaching and learning. I don't want to draw such a broad brush, say like every classroom is like this, because of course it's not. You visited 200 schools. That's evidence in and of itself. But that overall, the way we think about education probably hasn't evolved as much as it should have in the past century or so. And this is actually an issue that we've talked about on Radio Boston a lot because I'm kind of obsessed with it. And it came up surprisingly in a conversation that I had with Joy Ito last year. Mm-hmm. He's the head of the MIT Media Lab, right? And he wrote this book about called Whiplash, about how societies can cope with what the future and technology is going to bring. And his co-author, Jeff Howe, who's at Northeastern, talked to me about why American education really sort of lags in terms of what's needed for the 21st century. And he talked about Horace Mann. So I just want you to listen to this, Ted.
Horace Mann comes in the 19th century and reforms American education to make it compulsory, so everyone's going. But to
to make people who could then go out and act like a widget. And this was a philanthropic urge. Like, he wanted people to be able to survive and be employed. The problem now is that if Horace Mann were alive, he'd be like, hey, dummies, drop it. Like, it's the opposite. If people are going to act like machines, our machines got really good. Like, it's the one way they'll never be employed. Is if they, so they have to become good at stuff that machines can't do. Meanwhile, our educational system is teaching them to do things that machines can do. It's crazy. Yeah.
Do you think it's crazy, Ted?
Well, I agree with the quote. Joey's an interesting example of college dropout. He did this experiment with one of his MIT students where he wired her up with an EEG and tracked her during the week. And you see these periods where it's at a dead stop, zeroed out level for periods of time. You think that's when she's sleeping. That's when she's in a lecture hall.
What? An MIT student?
Yeah, for a week. And you can Google his blog and that has it. Or my book I wrote with Tony Wagner has that as well. So I agree, but I also disagree.
Okay.
You know, it's sort of an established entrenched model. It's not something you find just in bad schools. I mean, I've been to most of the top expensive private schools in Boston. You can find an awful lot of teachers talking at students, students taking notes, cramming for recall-based exams. And the point I make is if a student today in America is really good at content memorization, replicating low-level procedures, formulaic writing, and following instructions, they can generally be, if not valedictorian, in the top 10 of their class. And those are exactly the skills and competencies of machine intelligence. But, and what I found as I traveled and what I write about and celebrate is, first, great things are happening everywhere.
Right.
There are some really remarkable examples of innovation in any community. And the second thing is, don't blame the teachers for this. They are being held accountable to low-level standardized tests. And when you are held accountable to certain metrics, you are getting up every morning having to make a choice between doing what will look better on the test or what's better for the child.
So what did teachers then in the 200 places that you visit, what did they tell you that they need?
Trust.
From?
From parents, from their principal, from other teachers. You know, and I visited Emporia, Kansas. It's the National Teachers Hall of Fame. They have this knoll with a little chapel, and they have all these tombstones up with teachers that have given their lives for students. And in the book, I make the observation, we trust teachers with the lives of our students, but we don't trust them with their lesson plans. It doesn't make any sense. And so these teachers have entered the profession to engage and inspire kids, yet we micromanage their curriculum and determine whether they're a good teacher or not based on MCAS scores in Massachusetts. And you go and I always tell adults, look at the questions on, you know, some sample online questions from these tests and ask, are these important things to you as an adult later in life? And they really, you know, you look at it, I say it's one hop over from crossword puzzles and Sudoku.
Well, so, okay, so since you took us there to accountability and to testing, let me just ask you, I mean, the pushback to what you're saying is, for example, I mean, let's talk about MCAS. There are a lot of people, and I think this is a very persuasive argument, who would say that since 1993, when Massachusetts passed its education reform and said MCAS is going to be a measure by which how much schools are achieving or doing right by their students, that it is one of the reasons why the state, on average, as a whole, performs really well. It's one of the best performing states in the country. And, you know, Massachusetts educators like to say perhaps in the world. So, you know, isn't there some use for testing, for assessments in order to see how far students have come or have yet to go?
I think we owe it to any child that they develop learning how to learn skills. You know, can they read? Can they write effectively? Do they have basic math skills? You know, those are important things. And I think standardized tests used thoughtfully and diagnostically can play a role in that. But we do kind of the opposite, which is we amp up the stakes on these tests in the higher grades. During the period of time, kids should be developing distinctive capabilities and the types of things that are very hard to test, you know, creativity, boldness, thinking, you know, outside the box, all collaboration, all the things that really matter to adults in the workplace today. Those are things you can't standardize tests. They are what people, I think, pejoratively refer to as soft skills. They're not soft. There's nothing soft about them. They're hard to develop and hard to be excellent at. But those are the things that should be amplified in the higher grades. And I think that they largely lose out in the crush for take AP. You know, great example. A lot of people think that's a pinnacle of education. You know, when I interview most students about what they learned in their AP course, it's often, I learned I never want to take this subject again.
I mean, or I learned how to get a 5 on the AP exam.
Yeah. Exactly. Or, and you go to any bookstore and you'll see shelves of AP flashcards. And you know, what's interesting, I mean, the testing organizations argue that they're trying to get at more nuanced skills. But it's very difficult to grade those. You know, if it can be graded by a computer, it can be done by a computer. And so if you're looking for distinctive voice and writing, that's a very difficult thing to find the right caliber of person to be able to evaluate an essay. Mm. And so that generally gets pushed to the side in the standardized test march.
Yeah. So I want to go back to another example that you bring up in the book. This is in Fargo, North Dakota, at Ben Franklin Middle School, their eighth grade history class. Because I think maybe some people might think that this innovative sort of project-based approach that you seem to be advocating, maybe that's in the world of the science and the math classes. But their history class in Fargo was doing something interesting. What did they do there?
They were given the leeway, and it was sort of invented by the students and teachers in conjunction, again, supported by principal and superintendent of that district. And I'm in Fargo a lot, so I know these guys quite well. They asked these kids, what is some aspect of your community's history you'd love to capture? And they noodle, and they say there's some really interesting buildings in downtown Fargo. So small student teams picked buildings, did the research, then the idea just picked up steam. Could we do a photo collage? Could we turn it into a mini documentary? Could we do signs for the building with a QR code that then goes to the video? And they then subsequently turned all this into something longer, submitted it to the Fargo Film Festival. So it's got a little bit of technology, but it's mostly history. So that's a great blending. But it's also teaching these kids to think like historians. You know, instead of memorizing facts, which I think we do too much of in many history classes, they have to think like a historian would think about approaching and capturing and relating to other people the history of, you know, the local mill in, you know, on Main Street. Or, you know, they each sort of in their own way come up with a distinctive approach for telling the story of that building.
Yeah. So it seems as if in the book you sort of summarize a set of characteristics in all of these places that you say are working. And again, to just buttress a point you made earlier, there's no sort of one size fits all here that you're advocating for. It's not like whatever they're doing in Fargo, you're saying they should just pick that up and, you know, drop it in, I don't know, Lawrence, Massachusetts necessarily. But you do say in the book that you find that there were these commonalities in the environments where you saw students thrive. Purpose, essentials, where students are acquiring the skill sets and mindsets needed in an increasingly innovative world. Agency, where students are owning their own learning. And knowledge, where student learning is deep and retained, as you were talking about earlier. So PEAK is the acronym that you created out of that. Given the current challenges of in education, how is it that teachers, principals, school districts can better incorporate these four attributes into day-to-day learning?
Yeah. One of the challenges in the book, I mean, no two of these experiences were the same. And I actually don't advocate, I'm doing my best to tell the story of the teachers and showing what happens when teachers are trusted. So I'm really amplifying their stories instead of saying everybody needs to do X, because there is an awful lot in our world of former business guys, particularly tech business guys, deciding they can tell everybody what they need to do. And I try to be the opposite of that. I try to support, you know, almost be like the blocking back on a football team, clearing the way for teachers to do what they're passionate to do.
Okay, but just let me jump in here, Ted, to be clear, because I did introduce you as a former venture capitalist, right? You're a partner emeritus at Charles River Ventures. And look, you hit on something that's really important with Bill Gates, Mark Zuckerberg, you know, all other sort of nameless billionaires out there who all of a sudden have become really passionate about reforming American education. Did you meet some pushback from folks when you went around the country? Because I imagine a lot of teachers just looked at you and said, oh, here comes another one.
Teachers, I mean, I would, when I meet teachers, particularly when I talk to groups, I always preface it. I start by saying, I know how you feel when somebody's introduced as a former business person interested in education. And if you're saying to yourself, here we go again, I feel your pain, I understand, and I'm trying to make up for this. Because a lot of those initiatives have not made any sense. They've been anywhere from unproductive to counterproductive. But I think what what's interesting is I've actually done my homework. You know, I haven't just done a few photo ops. I mean, I've been out there traveling relentlessly, meeting, hearing, listening to, trying to understand. And I do have a lens of what's going to lead to kids that could actually do well in a world of innovation, you know, because I've seen it. I've worked with a bunch of younger people, and I know what kinds of backgrounds I think we're going to help them, and I know which ones will be counterproductive. Yeah. And so I think there's this really interesting combination, and I think there's a fair amount of, I'd say as I travel and I talk about something as simple as aligning school with life, mm-hmm. you know, nobody really says that makes no sense. And right. so I don't get pushback on some of the fundamentals, but I think a lot of business people, if you just talk to them, will think, you know, it's the teachers or it's the teacher unions or it's the monopoly of the local school. There are a bunch of problem type of formulaic things that some people will say without ever really stopping to look, dig in, meet with people and have any kind of perspective on it. And I think you'll see teachers as well. Some will just say, you have never been a classroom teacher, kind of shut up and go away. I think if we're going to really make our schools great, there needs to be two-way discussion there. And I think business people have a lot they can do to support and help our schools. And I think teachers, I'm a big fan of teachers shadowing students and out in the workplace. And so if you had an English teacher with some students sitting in and watching your show, they'd find that really interesting. And teachers, I think, actually are quite curious about what happens out, you know, in the professional environment when you're outside of school. Right. So I think there's a lot to be learned from each other.
So Ted, I have to ask you, because you mentioned that aligning school with life. And you write exactly those words in a chapter about social equity. And first of all, I just want to ask you, I mean, again, to get back to testing for a second. There are lots of folks who say testing is the window by which that gives us a view in terms of about how we might go about, or if we are adequately going about, closing achievement gaps. And so you say that this raises a profound question. If we align school with life, could we elevate learning for all kids while closing an authentic achievement gap? Did you see a school in the 200 that you visited that was doing this measurably?
Absolutely. You know, so the point I make is, I met thousands and thousands of kids. Not one is interested in test prep. Not one. And so if you make school largely around test prep, you know, cram for the SAT, you know, memorize flashcards, you're not reflecting the child's interest, talents, and potential. You're reflecting how much the parents are pushing the kid. And I think that's why the rich families do better on that stuff than the poor families. I go to a lot of schools. I was just this morning at a school in the Bronx where these kids actually are doing really well on their test scores, but the school had nothing to do with test prep. I mean, these kids are composing music, writing the lyric, you know, hip-hop, 3D printing, designing, you know.
I see.
And they said, why don't we start with what the kids are really interested in? If the kids can't wait to get to school, this is a public school in the Bronx, they will learn. And I think what we've done is we've inverted that. We've said, somehow we've convinced ourselves that if a kid memorizes obstreperous and can factor polynomials and test well with that, that we've done that kid a favor.
I got the opposite. Let me jump in here. So for the example that you just gave about the school in the Bronx, the tests were still there, but the learning was not geared at all to the tests. And in fact, because of that, they were learning more and performing better on the tests.
Right.
Interesting. Okay.
And you know, you saw it in the film. I did this film with great director Greg Whiteley,
yeah, most likely to succeed. Right.
Yeah, and those kids do just fine on the tests, but they're not doing any test prep in the school. But it's very difficult. It's easy for me to say here from a studio or writing a book to your kids will do just fine. But when those test results are published in the newspaper, the magazine, when your school is rated by those test scores, boom, it's very difficult to say, let's just focus on stuff the kids love to learn and trust the fact or hope for the fact that the test scores will be fine. Right. So we send this message to the teachers that you're going to be evaluated on the basis of this, I think, largely obsolete set of metrics. But then we can't really just say and don't pay that much attention to it.
We just got a minute or two here to go, Ted. So my last question is, I want to come back to something you said earlier, that the number one thing teachers tell you that they need to succeed more for their students in the classroom is trust. So that means trust from school committees, trust from district level leaders. And I would say that, is it also true that those district level leaders who want to bring about change need trust from legislators, from governors, from, you know, the Department of Education? And if so, how are we going to change that dynamic? Because it sounds like you're asking almost everyone in the educational chain to give up a little control here.
Or give up a lot of control.
Or
but
a lot.
I write about New Hampshire. So neighbor to the north, New Hampshire, which from, you know, the years 2002 to 2008 had an incredible transformation of education. They trusted the teachers to put in place, develop a next generation form of accountability, which they did, based on tangible evidence of student work. And the standards were actually really high, but they trusted the teachers to lead the way with that. And so it was performance-based, competency-based. And the quality of work that the students are doing is much higher than it is in neighboring states. And I'll tell you this, when I visit, and I've been to a lot of schools in New Hampshire, those kids ask better questions by a lot than a lot of the adults in states I went to.
Wow. Well, the new book is called What School Could Be: Insights and Inspiration from Teachers Across America. It's by Ted Dinsersmith. He's also producer of a 2015 movie called Most Likely to Succeed. Ted Dinsersmith, it's been great to have you. Thank you so much for joining us again today.
Thank you, and love your show.
Well, that's it for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR station. Our show is produced by Jamie Bologna, Chris Siderick, and we had help today from Zoe Mitchell, Amy Pollard, Cassandra Sunt, and Lily Tyson. Tim Skog is our technical director. Our executive producer is Hitesh Hathi. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. And by the way, if you want some links to all the other education conversations we've had, go to our website, radioboston.org. This is Radio Boston.